5-3. Tonight, the Brewers play in Arizona. The Cubs and White Sox are off. NBA playoffs last night, the Eastern Conference Finals, Boston beat Cleveland 108-83. Tonight, the Western Conference Finals, Golden State takes on Houston. Now that WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Monday, May 14th. Cloudy, warm, and windy, and rainy. Patchy fog throughout the day. A high of 73 inland, cooler near Lake Michigan. Looking at the radar right now, still rain moving through the area. It's quite a system still behind it. So there will be rain moving through the area for the better part of the morning hours. Here are the numbers, 58 degrees now in Racine and Kenosha, 59 in Milwaukee. Wind is from the south-southeast at 10 miles per hour. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, we're going to be exploring some of the incredible breakthroughs that have occurred in technology as it relates to surveillance and some of the complicated issues that are raised. The book at hand is called Habeas Data, Privacy versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech. The author, Sarus Farivar, is the senior business editor at Ars Technica, the author also of a very intriguing book called The Internet Elsewhere. He is also a radio producer, and his work has appeared on National Public Radio, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, The Economist, Wired, New York Times, and other outlets. His book, Habeas Data, is published by Melville House. One of the things I appreciated in the book's introduction is how you essentially admit to or confess to being really dazzled, like most of us, just after the turn of the century with the emergence of all kinds of technologies. I think, like most of us, you were pretty much bedazzled and probably saw most of these dramatic new technologies in largely positive light. Explain how your concerns about such technologies began to sort of coalesce in your mind. What began to, in a sense, heighten your sense of concern and even alarm?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of us in 2013, when Edward Snowden stepped forward, I think a lot of us started to think about privacy and government surveillance in an entirely new way. You know, and I have been interested in technology, you know, just as a, you know, smartphones and laptops and various online services and all the rest. But, you know, I really hadn't thought a whole lot about what that means for, you know, surveillance technology and what that technology enables us to do. You know, so just to give one example, right, one of the things that Edward Snowden revealed was what was called the Section 215 metadata program. This was the program that lasted from 2001 until 2015, and it actually continues today, although in a modified form. But what that did is the government collected all of our call records through this program under Section 215 of the law. And so what that means is that, you know, it shows it doesn't the NSA is not listening to people's calls, but they are capturing who called who and when and for how long. And you know, that what we call metadata, that metadata reveals or can reveal quite a lot about somebody's behavior, right? Imagine if a woman, if you see on a call record a woman calls, you know, her romantic partner and then calls a, you know, another relative and then calls a an abortion clinic or her doctor, right? You can draw some legitimate inferences from just those few facts.
Even if you've not heard the content of any of those actual phone calls.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
By the way, before we go any further, can you just further clarify this term metadata? Because it's obviously an important term. And beyond just giving us examples of it, can you just untie that term for us?
Sure. So data, of course, is just a Latin word for information, right? And we use it often in a scientific and government sense. Meta, of course, refers to things that are over or on top of. So metadata refers to data about data. So in the context of phone calls, for example, that would mean not the content of the data, but the non-content, right? So person A called person B on Tuesday morning at, you know, 7:30 in the morning, and they called each other for 5 minutes, right? So that is just information that describes the content, what people actually said. It might be easier to understand if you think about it in terms of, you know, a physical paper letter, right? There's the physical paper letter inside the envelope, but in the outside of the envelope is, you know, written in pen and ink is the address from and the address to. And those addresses are easily viewable to anybody who's handling that piece of mail.
Mm. Interesting. And of course, that is the kind of information that has become so easy for the government and law enforcement agencies to secure. And your book explores some of the questions that should legitimately be raised about that. One of the things you explore towards the beginning of the book to help us kind of understand the scope of what is possible is when you talk about something called LPR data and the way in which, for instance, you yourself ended up supplying a great deal of LPR data, or a lot of LPR data was gathered about you for no particular reason at all. Explain what this is and in a sense, what it is indicative of.
Sure. So LPR stands for license plate reader. Sometimes they're called automated license plate reader, ALPR, but either one is fine. So LPRs are a technology that has become increasingly prevalent in cities big and small all over America. They're in use where I live in Oakland. They're in use where you are. I don't know 100%, but I would bet. They're in use in, you know, many, many places around America. And these are specialized cameras that are typically mounted on top of police cars. So next time you see a police car roll by in your community, take a quick look at it and see if you can spot a small black rectangle, you know, roughly the size of like a smartphone, mounted in front of the light bar, the red and blue flashing lights on the top of police cars. And they're mounted usually just a few inches in front of those, pointed at 45-degree angles away from the car. And what they're doing is they're scanning at incredible speed, 60 plates per second at a maximum rate, all plates that they see. So cars that are traveling, you know, parallel to the police car, away from it, in every which direction, and capturing those license plates. Then they're comparing those license plates to what police call a hot list. So these are cars that are, suspected of some wrongdoing. Maybe there's a person who's a fugitive from justice. Maybe there's somebody who is believed to be involved in some sort of Amber Alert situation, some sort of, you know, child abduction or whatever. But, you know, that the police have some interest in trying to locate a person that's affiliated with this particular car. So the computers in these cars are scanning all cars, again, at incredible speeds, doing a lightning-quick comparison to plates that they want to interact with, that they want to be alerted to. But if there is an alert, then the officer is alerted, and the officer can proceed however he or she sees fit. If not, then oftentimes that data is simply kept by the police. It's retained for days or weeks or months, sometimes years. And so I filed a public records request with the Oakland Police Department a couple years ago to find out records about myself, and I was a little bit surprised to find out that, you know, 4 years earlier they had seen me at, you know, 15 intersections around town. Even though I have never been arrested, I, as far as I know, I'm not under investigation. I've never committed any crimes. And so I didn't really understand what the purpose was for the Oakland Police Department to continue to keep that kind of data about me.
Mm-hmm. Your book ends up exploring 10 different court cases that in various ways revolve around this whole matter of the data that is being gathered about us, the extent to which our privacy is perhaps violated, and of course, ultimately is raising kind of the question of what we do about this, and how much of this is okay, is any of this okay, what is to be done. I wish we had more time to explore the specifics, but one of the most interesting cases is actually one of the oldest as well. The first chapter involves a phone booth case in the early 1960s. But in a sense, the tactics of one of the attorneys involved, Harvey Schneider, really helped kind of build a new framework for thinking about privacy and where we can expect privacy. Just say a quick word about this court case and the argument made by this attorney that you obviously find so compelling.
Sure. So, you know, before Harvey Schneider and the Katz case came along, and so Katz, just very, very briefly, involved a guy in Los Angeles in the 1960s. He was a gambler, Charles Katz. He liked to go to certain phone booths on Sunset Boulevard and call bookies on the East Coast and make bets, particularly about college basketball. And, of course, you know, interstate gambling is illegal, so he drew the attention of law enforcement. And the police ultimately put microphones and recording devices on top of the phone booths that he was using without a warrant. They believed that they didn't need a warrant to do that. When he was ultimately arrested and ultimately taken to his apartment, where the police did have a warrant to search, and they found all kinds of betting papers and various other materials, he went to trial. He was found guilty. He appealed. And yes, as you say, this young lawyer, he was 30 years old at the time, Harvey Schneider, had a really interesting concept of this, you know, for this particular case. And he was saying that, you know, because before there was this legal precedent where the court looked at what was called constitutionally protected areas. Things like a home, for example, would certainly be protected. And really, you know, a lot of the ideas of the Fourth Amendment at that time revolved around physical trespass. So this is why the police did not put the microphones inside the phone booth, but rather just up to the line, you know, right up on the roof of the phone booth. So instead, what Harvey Schneider, you know, had this idea was, he said, well, you know, maybe it's not so much about the place where the action is taking place. Maybe it's really about kind of the individual. Maybe it's really about, you know, where you are and what you expect, what is reasonable to expect, you know, if an outside observer were to be looking into this situation, right? You know, I think most of us, when we're home, we don't expect to be surveilled by the police. And so if the police are, you know, peering into our homes using you know, some sort of technology to do that, in most cases, they do need a warrant in order to do that. And so Harvey Schneider, he argued successfully that if the police want to surveil somebody inside a phone booth, they need a warrant for that. And so this is what has sort of been distilled into this phrase that still resonates with us today, this, quote, reasonable expectation of privacy.
Right. And I like the way it's he says at one point, we feel that the right to privacy follows the individual, that the right to privacy is not limited to the square footage of a person's home or other particular places, but that privacy is such a fundamental right that it goes with us at least almost anywhere we go, or into many different settings. And of course, what's intriguing about that is the possibility then that privacy is such a fundamental right that it also, in a sense, should follow us even into the midst of ever-changing technologies that are constantly kind of altering the specifics of how our lives play out and how this matter of privacy also plays out.
Right, and then you sort of get, this is where the lawyers come in, right, which is to say they like to argue over the nuances of what these words actually mean. So, there's a different case that I write about. You were talking about license plate readers a moment ago, right? There's a different case that says there is no reasonable expectation of privacy when you are in public, right? So when you are in public, when you're walking down a public street, when you're driving down a public road, people can see you. We all know this, right? We all have license plates on our cars. Those license plates, by definition, are visible to anybody. That's the entire purpose of a license plate. But what I think a lot of us don't anticipate is that while probably all of us, most of us, would be okay with, one officer doing kind of targeted investigation or targeted inquiry, if an officer saw my car parked, on my street and wanted to know who that car belonged to, I would have no issue with the officer, calling into headquarters or obtaining my DMV records or whatever to find out information about me or about anybody that they, had some reason to believe, was up to no good. I take issue with the fact that there's a machine now that exists that, again, is in use in cities all over America right now that can make this work significantly faster. 60 plates per second is an incredible speed. That makes the job of the officer so much easier when they can just drive down a street and have a computer do it for them at speeds that no team of humans could possibly ever do.
Mm. I want to make sure that I mention the fact that for a time you lived and worked in Germany. That seems to have been an important experience for you in that you saw for yourself the way in which Germany and many Germans view some of these questions and in a sense seem to have wrestled with them maybe more aggressively than we in America have, at least in some respect. How important was that experience in Germany? What did you take away from that is valuable to this conversation and to this topic?
Sure. So, yeah, I lived in Germany for 2 years in Bonn, Germany, near Cologne on the western side of the country, from 2010 to 2012. And when I first arrived in the spring of 2010, Google Street View had just arrived in Germany. It was brand new, and they were rolling it out in different cities. And by that point, Google Street View had already been, in the U.S. for a number of years. I think most of us, when Google Street View came out, in the U.S., we thought it was kind of interesting and curious. There was no real kind of mainstream backlash to it against it in the U.S., as far as I know. I think most of us thought it was kind of neat. You could show, anybody, what your street looks like, what your house looks like, what your community looks like. But in Germany, it was a totally different ballgame. A lot of people, a lot of politicians, a lot of just regular citizens felt very uncomfortable that, a foreign company had, without telling anybody, without asking for permission, had just driven cars around major German cities and captured detailed images on every single street in those cities. And a lot of people were very concerned, and they felt that it was very, very invasive of their privacy. And that's what I think really kind of set me down this path, is to try to understand, what are some of the kind of cultural norms that allow a country like Germany to be really kind of against that. Maybe they're okay or they're more trusting of their own government in some way. Another thing that in Germany that they do that's a common practice that everyone has to do, whether you're a foreigner or a native German, is you have to register yourself at city halls. So when you arrive in a city, if you live in Bonn, Germany, as I did, one of the very first things I had to do was present myself to city hall and just tell them who I was and show them my documents, and they would register me. And then when I left the country, when I left town, even if I'd moved cities, I would have had to have deregistered myself from the city hall. And I think imagining that in America, I think most of us would be very uncomfortable by the idea of having to present ourselves every time we're, formally arriving in a city or leaving. Everybody does it. They don't think twice about it. They're totally not bothered by it, and yet they're bothered by Google Street View.
Hmm. And I'm very, very grateful to Sarus Farva for agreeing to rejoin me for a second interview to allow me the chance to ask him a few more questions about this very complex and important topic and his interesting book called Habeas Data, Privacy Versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech. Cyrus Farivar, thank you for this additional time.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it. As I was reflecting on what we talked about and reflecting on your book, I was realizing that so much of this book actually is as much about the law as it is about technology and these new technologies that allow for an unprecedented level of surveillance. And I wonder what kind of a challenge it was for you to be able to handle those kind of matters and write about them with the intelligence and perception that you do. I mean, do you have some sort of background in your own professional life that equipped you, or did you have to sort of experience a steep learning curve of your own in order to really be able to understand and write well about that facet of all this?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a law student. I've never been a law student. It has become, part of my job, essentially, to interview lawyers, law professors, various experts in recent years to try to understand these issues. Because, I think as you correctly perceived, it can be a little bit kind of impenetrable sometimes to dig into what the law means, what it says, what some of these phrases mean, reasonable expectation of privacy, what does that mean? And to really try to understand some of these terms and challenges.
Very much so. And I think it's interesting when you, for instance, share with us fairly detailed and extensive excerpts from, for instance, discussions at the U.S. Supreme Court about some of these cases and disputes. We really get a sense that there are some extremely thorny questions to address. And one can be a perfectly intelligent and rational human being and fall on one side or the other of some of these questions. And I think that's something that we don't always experience. A lot of what we talk about and bandy around will be issues in which there is a very clear sort of right answer and wrong answer, at least as far as we're personally concerned. But boy, many of these questions are actually quite complicated. And it seems like a mistake to treat these questions too simplistically.
Absolutely. I mean, I think if there's one lesson that I've learned from all of this, it's that, privacy is hard, and coming up with the right balance about what the government's power should be and under what circumstances they can use certain tools should be is not an immediately obvious question. I think we all need to think about in our own communities and speak with our local men and women in uniform, our lawmakers, our policymakers, our city council members, our state legislators, to try to come up with, and have a substantive dialogue and figure out how do we balance, on the one hand, the needs of law enforcement to protect us all. I live in Oakland, California, a city that tragically experiences an average of 80 murders per year. Obviously, I would wish that zero people would be murdered per year. But at the same time, I know that that it might be possible to do that, but that it might involve infringing on a lot of civil rights and civil liberties in order to achieve that goal. So, all of us, I think, have to try to figure out what the best way forward is. And it's not something that's easy. And I think it only really comes through a kind of thoughtful discussion between all of those parties.
Right. And so for once, I think we're talking about an issue where one can value privacy, one can value law and order and public safety, and in a sense, the heart of the matter is figuring out how much and how to value both of those really important things. And the fact that they're both important, and in some respects probably equally important or comparably important, is part of what makes this especially vexing. That is the question of how to achieve a balance.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think that there is an inherent opposition between, law enforcement and privacy. I think it's possible to craft laws and rules that make it that really underscore the importance of protecting people's civil rights and civil liberties. In my home state of California, for example, for a couple years now, we've had something called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, ECPA. And there's a federal version of this, but the California version, Cal-ECPA, imposes, for example, among other things, it imposes a warrant requirement for the use of a Stingray device, a cell site simulator, essentially a fake cell phone tower. This is a tool that's commonly used by law enforcement all over America. And now in California, there's a state law that says, okay, police, if you want to use this tool, you got to get a warrant first. That's it. You know, absent, you know, exigent circumstances, absent, you know, other well-known exceptions to the Fourth Amendment, it says, okay, you do have to go through this warrant process. That's currently not the case federally, although DOJ and DHS and other federal agencies have said that they will on their own impose such a rule. That has only come in recent years due to kind of public pressure and journalism and activism and such. But, you know, as of right now, there is no federal law, you know, requiring that a warrant be used for a Stingray, for example.
I think the chapters, there's more than one in which you talk about the information that we have on our phones and how that information can be tremendously valuable to, for instance, law enforcement authorities, government authorities, and so on. It of course runs hand in hand with the convenience we want from our phones, that we want to be able to pour all of this stuff into them or get all of this stuff out of them, but it ends up then being this repository for all kinds of information that can be of great value, but also can really, in a sense, compromise one's sense of privacy. It kind of brings to mind the whole question of what this device even is that's sitting in my pocket right now. And in a sense, to call it a phone is almost a misnomer. I mean, compared to the object that once upon a time was hooked to the wall and it had a cord and so on. Can you just talk a moment about the nature of what this device actually is and, in a sense, how we need to be thinking about it maybe differently than we often do?
Sure. I mean, you know, the smartphones that we all carry in our pockets, they obviously make phone calls, but I think actually very few of us, although I am talking to you on one right now, but, you know, it's not even every day that I'm on my phone to make a phone call, right? They could just as easily be called, you know, pocket computers or something else, right? They serve so many other purposes other than simply just making phone calls. I think a lot of us use them to search the internet. We use them as our pocket calendar. We use them as our, personal address book. We use them to communicate through text message, other messaging apps with one another, to conduct online banking, maybe to store health records. We use them for all kinds of things. And a traditional, you know, voice-to-voice phone call is sort of an ancillary application.
You're listening to an interview which I recorded with Cyrus Farivar, the author of a book called Habeas Data, Privacy Versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech. In this fascinating book, Cyrus Farivar examines some of the incredible breakthroughs that have occurred in technology which allow for surveillance to be done at an unprecedented level, surveillance by government agencies and or law enforcement officials, surveillance that can be done in all of our lives without us even knowing it's being done. And the book examines some of the complicated issues that this raises about how much privacy we can afford and where is the healthy balance between privacy versus law and order and the public safety and the collective good. I appreciate that Cyrus Farivar allowed me to call him back to ask him a few more questions that arose out of our initial conversation.
The Stingray, so it's important for people to understand, when I use the word Stingray and when a lot of people use the word Stingray, there is a trademarked specific device called a Stingray that is made by a company in Florida called the Harris Corporation. The Harris Corporation is a longstanding publicly traded defense contractor. And they're probably the most well-known example of manufacturers of this device. The sort of generic term is a cell site simulator. So oftentimes people will use the word Stingray like we use the word Kleenex or the word Xerox, right? It's a specific trademark term that has come to mean the generic because it's the largest example of that thing. So whether you call it a Stingray, a cell site simulator, an IMSI catcher, right, these all mean the same thing. What they are at their core, they are devices that act as fake cell towers. They broadcast out into the world, and they overwhelm other nearby legitimate cell phone towers. And if you're a law enforcement agency, the reason why you might want to do that is because all of our phones, right, are designed to automatically connect to the strongest tower. And if you think about it, like, that makes a lot of sense because, you know, how many of us have had the experience of having a cell phone call drop on us, right? It's a very frustrating experience. So we want there to be a strong signal as often as possible, right? So your phone is designed to do that. It's not going to take any steps to try to figure out which one is a legitimate tower, which one is not. So by definition, based on no matter what phone you have, it's designed to look for the strongest signal. So Stingrays take advantage of this fact, and they broadcast a fake signal that essentially is able to intercept the calls and the text messages, and also really at a more basic level, figure out where your phone is, right? Because again, your cell phone provider knows where you are. They know where you are because they want to be able to provide you with cell phone service. So similarly, a fake tower would be able to locate you as well. And that's what law enforcement oftentimes are using these devices for. They're turning them on and they're kind of blanketing a certain area with a strong fake signal as a way to figure out where somebody's phone is.
Right. And what you say in this chapter is part of the problem is that Stingrays are not targeted devices. They don't just go after one device at a time. Explain that a little further. I mean, because someone might read those words and say, so what's the problem with that? And clearly you see a very big problem with that fact that such a device is not targeted in what it does.
Right. So, you know, the Stingray, when it's first turned on, right, it doesn't, if the police are targeting me, for example, right, I'm sitting in a room right now talking to you on the phone inside an office building. If the police were sitting outside of this office building right now, the Stingray would be affecting the communications of everybody in the building, maybe everybody on the block, maybe a wider range than that, depending how powerfully they had set it up. And so the police would be able to locate not only me if I was their target, but other people as well. And also, you know, it's important to remember, as a fake tower, right, your calls and texts and other data that your phone is transmitting would not be able to be transmitted legitimately because they're being intercepted by this fake tower. So imagine if you live next door to me and you need to call 911 at the exact moment that I am being surveilled through this Stingray, your 911 call is not going to go through because your 911 call is just going to go to this fake tower and it's not going to go anywhere.
Hmm. And then, of course, beyond that is the whole notion of an enormous amount of data being collected about an enormous number of people who are actually not the targets, not the intended targets of such surveillance. And in a sense, the one of the more troubling issues here is that sort of ancillary data that is gathered sort of inadvertently in a sense.
Right, yeah, and I think that's one of the questions that is posed with a lot of these new types of surveillance technologies is, yes, they're invasive, but the ability of government entities to capture large amounts of information in kind of one fell swoop, whether it's license plates, whether it's, location data of a phone, whether it's, you know, any kinds of things, is really troublesome. And I think raises a lot of new questions as to, again, as we talked about earlier, what is the appropriate balance between allowing the government to do its job of legitimate law enforcement, but also protecting the rights of people who are regular law-abiding taxpaying citizens.
Do I remember correctly from this chapter that that purchasing and using a device like this is almost completely unregulated? Is that what you were you referring to here in America or someplace else in terms of this kind of device being unregulated?
I don't know. I mean, so the you know, so if you call the Paris Corporation and said, "Hi, I'm a regular person and not a police officer, and I want to buy a Stingray," they won't sell you one, right? You know, going as far back as 2010, a woman named Kristen Padgett was able to demonstrate that she'd built a very kind of rudimentary Stingray for about $1,500 in parts, right? And I think that shows that you know, while there may not be a commonly accessible off-the-shelf version of this, the technology is well understood, right? I was just in Seattle earlier this week, and I was speaking with some researchers at the University of Washington, and they are building for what they described as, you know, several hundred dollars worth of hardware. They're trying to essentially reverse engineer the commercial Stingray.
Wow. This raises kind of a personal question that I wanted to raise with you, namely that, I mean, my own personal feelings on this issue are really actually not all that pertinent, really not pertinent at all, but I want to share them nevertheless. And that is that, for good or ill, this kind of question on a very personal level, just for whatever reason, doesn't particularly bother me. I mean, it does on kind of an intellectual level. It's like my brain tells me I should be more worried about this than I am in my gut. For some reason, this just is not as disconcerting to me personally as I think it should be. I don't know if I'm expressing myself very clearly, but I think we're all a little different, and we're all on different places on the scale in terms of some people being very inclined to being very troubled, to other people who just kind of blithely go on with their lives and just feeling like this is okay. Maybe complicated, but I'm not particularly bothered. I'm not staying up at night worrying about the data about me that's being collected or the ways in which I am potentially being surveyed. What do you find out there from various people that you talk to in terms of kind of their visceral personal reaction to all this? And what do you want our reaction, in a sense, to be?
I mean, I think you're right. A lot of us have different responses. Some of us may be wholly unbothered by this. Some of us may say, well, you know, we want the police to catch more bad guys. You know, as I said earlier, Oakland, where I live, is a city where 80 people get murdered a year. And I bet there are people in Oakland who would say, you know, we should have more cameras. We should have more drones. We should have more Stingrays.
Not less. Not less, have more.
Right. I think some people would argue that, right? Like I talk about in the book, a company that's called Persistent Surveillance Systems. This is an aerial surveillance company that has tested their aerial hardware. It's essentially a plane, a Cessna, with very incredibly detailed cameras, and they fly them over cities. They're a company based out of Dayton, Ohio, but they've tested them in Baltimore and Los Angeles and other places. And the idea is to, again, like some of these other technologies that we're talking about, capture from up in the sky, right, what people are doing down below, how different cars are moving around, how people are biking around, walking around, whatever they're doing, as a way to, you know, they describe it almost as like a TiVo in the sky, to be able to turn it into a time machine, to be able to look back in time a week ago, a month ago, to see where people were and what they were doing as in the name of fighting crime, right? And again, a lot of us, I think, want there to be less crime in our communities. We are concerned with public safety. We want law enforcement to do legitimate law enforcement work. You know, it's a little bit frustrating when you have a situation where a company like this, you know, is not really telling people what they're doing, right? They're, in the case of, you know, the Persistent Surveillance Systems was testing this in Los Angeles. And in my book, I quote a Los Angeles Sheriff's Department who spoke to a local media outlet there, a guy by the name of Sergeant Doug Ikitani, who in 2014 said, you know, the system was kept confidential from everybody in the public. A lot of people do have a problem with the eye in the sky, the big brother. So in order to mitigate any kinds of those complaints, we basically kept it pretty hush-hush, right? So the local, the sheriffs are saying, we know that some people are bothered by this, so we didn't bother, you know, telling anybody. And I think that's very telling and very disturbing.
Right. That's not the solution that concerned people would want. they
right.
want their concern directly addressed. They don't want it, in a sense, hidden away.
Right.
I think when I think about, again, my own visceral feelings about this, I think one of the reasons why, on a kind of a personal gut level, it doesn't bother me so much is because of the what you describe as something that, in a sense, is happening to all of us. And I think some people are really bothered by this because, in a sense, they think of it in terms that are probably a little too personal. That is, they sort of picture somebody in City Hall or somebody at the police station hovering over all this data about me, when in fact they have mountains of data about everybody. And and in a sense, I maybe falsely find myself sort of comforted or encouraged by the fact that I'm not being singled out for this kind of intrusive surveillance. I'm one of a, you know, kind of a nameless, faceless mass of people. And I'm not sure that fact should make me less bothered about it. But in some ways, it kind of does. And I wonder if you've thought very much about that particular facet of this.
Yeah, I mean, I would say to the people who maybe say, well, you know, I'm not bothered by the fact that the police are capturing my license plate, or I'm not bothered by the fact that there might be a stingray and used to catch bad guys in my city. You know, I would say, well, think about how you yourself have privacy, right? Do you have locks on your house? Do you have drapes or curtains on your front door, front windows, or to the windows of your bedroom? Do you allow anybody to access your email inbox or your health records or things like that, right? I have said to many times, you know, if you're totally unbothered and you're totally not doing anything wrong, then surely you would have no problem of handing over your email password to me. And I haven't had anybody take me up on that offer.
Right.
So, you know, I think that while, you know, and maybe your police officers in your community are all entirely honorable people. I would like to believe that to be the case. But I think that's why it's important for police to have very clear rules and guidelines and regulations with meaningful penalties if they don't comply, to say, hey, you know, just because your town police or your city police or your county sheriff or whatever are, you know, all good and honorable, that doesn't necessarily mean that they will be all good and honorable forever, right? You know, officers turn over. There's always new recruits and new people coming to the city. So if we do want there to be clear rules, then we should ask of our law enforcement to say, hey, okay, you want to use these devices? Great. Let's come up with some clear guidelines as to how they should be used.
Hmm. Two more quick questions. Thank you for being so generous with your time. I'm speaking with Cyrus Farivar about his book, Habeas Data, Privacy Versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech. I wonder what your sense is about the people who have created these technologies, how much they wrestled with some of the issues that are raised in your book and that we have been talking about in this interview. And one of the reasons I ask that is because it's one thing when, for instance, somebody creates a social media platform like Facebook and in no way can possibly understand all of the ramifications of creating that platform or exactly the way it's going to come to be used 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road. One could conceivably be forgiven for not foreseeing every consequence.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in most cases, we are talking in this book about technology that is, in a sense, very much focused in its creation, created very much for a very direct purpose. I mean, in order to do this surveillance in this
mm-hmm.
way. I mean, and you can't necessarily foresee the ways in which someone might misuse it or use it for personal gain or whatever. But the technology, there's no mystery about why this technology has been created and the essential reason for it existing. That being said, How much of sort of ethical weighing has gone on with those who have brought these surveillance technologies into being? How much weighing of the ethics, weighing of the moral consequences, if any, has gone on? Do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think that is something that a lot of people that work in Silicon Valley are trying to figure out and trying to develop a kind of code of ethics. I think that that's something that I know that people are starting to think about that, you know, in the ways that other professions, medicine, journalism, many other fields have, you know, kind of clear ethics. I think that, you know, one thing that is often the dominant kind of ethos in Silicon Valley is to, you know, as Facebook put it, build, move fast and break things, right? That was Facebook's kind of one of Facebook's internal slogans for many, many years. And the result of moving fast and breaking things is that you might invade somebody's privacy, you might accidentally get data leaked, right? There might be like real world consequences as a result of that. You know, contrast that with the overriding, you know, medical ethos, which is first do no harm, right? That's the Hippocratic Oath, is that, you know, doctors are sworn to this principle. And so I think that, you know, now I would like to believe that people that work at different companies, whether they're involved in law enforcement activities or not, I think that they need to think long and hard about, you know, what is the worst case of the ramifications of this tool that I'm building? And hopefully, you know, that will give all of us, you know, better tools to work with.
I don't know how closely you watched the hearings on Capitol Hill that involved Mark Zuckerberg, the founder and CEO of Facebook. In answering some very pointed questions about Facebook and some of what has occurred there in terms of access to data that was unauthorized and I think just about everybody would agree, quite unfortunate. I'm curious to know what applicability you see in all of that to what we have been talking about today, and I also wonder your opinion of, for instance, people in our judicial system and our lawmakers as well, having to try to come up to speed in terms of these breakthroughs and making sense of them. I mean, in a sense, they need to do so even more than we do as private citizens and consumers, because they are formulating policy and or interpreting the rule of law about some of these groundbreaking technologies that leave a lot of us bewildered. Just curious about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that it's important to remember while, you know, some of our judges are our Supreme Court justices, you know, may be older. I mean, I'm 36 years old, and, you know, I think back to when I wrote about, you know, chapter one of my book as a case involving, you know, some espionage in a phone booth in Los Angeles from the mid-1960s. I think about how the attorney that represented the defendant in that case, Charles Katz, the attorney was a guy by the name of Harvey Schneider, and he was 30 years old. He was less than half of the you know, median age on the court, less than half as old as all of the justices on the court at that point. And I think now, you know, many of these Supreme Court justices, while they do range in age, I think they all have relatively young clerks, you know, probably law clerks who are my age, if not younger, right? And I would like to believe that the contemporary court, especially at the Supreme Court level, are hopefully being educated by, you know, their staff, their clerks, as to what the real world ramifications are of these technologies, and younger people are thinking about them.
Well, I appreciate the thoroughness of your book and also its fairness and even-handedness. I mean, I really hand it to you for tackling this complicated question in the way that you do. And I really hope that many people will seek out this book and learn from it as I did. Habeas Data, Privacy Versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech, published by Melville House, and the author, Seroush Farivar. Seroush Farivar, thank you for making time for some additional questions. I have really learned a lot from our conversation, and I thank you again.
You're welcome.
Tomorrow on the morning show, I will be going into the archives to replay a conversation which I recorded with historian John Meacham, a book called Franklin and Winston, Portrait of an Intimate Friendship. An intimate portrait of an epic friendship. And, of course, the book title refers to Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill. John Meacham is going to be a special guest at Carthage College on commencement weekend, the day before commencement. And this will be a